Good morning, everyone. This morning I want to have a bit of fun. Next week we're getting into a series called Under the Influence of the Sinister and Strange. So before we do that, I thought we'd have another week where we look into some marketing stuff, kind of like we did last week. I'm going to try to marry Terry O'Reilly with a theologian. We'll see how that goes. So, can you believe, in 2016, advertisers spent $543 billion worldwide trying to advertise to us, trying to convince us to buy their goods. Now, when you think about that, that works out to $77 for every single human being on the planet. That's how much advertisers spend every year advertising. In fact, our world is so cluttered with ads and branding that many estimates suggest that every single one of us sees 360 ads every day, which is just beyond crazy to me. I mean, the reality is we're sort of swimming in a sea of advertising, and in a world that spends that kind of money trying to get our attention, trying to put us under their influence, it raises an important question for me, and it's this: what is the world of marketing doing to us? And I don't mean how does it impact our spending habits, how it makes us consumers, that seems rather obvious, but what is it doing to the way we think and behave fundamentally? How does it sort of shape the way we see the world? Well, what I've come to believe is this: we're so bombarded with branding and advertising that we've actually internalized marketing practices as a way of life. We're swimming in a sea of advertising. We've come to see life. We've come to see our very selves through the lens of marketing. And so what I want to do this morning is highlight how marketing has affected us, how we see the world, how we see ourselves, and then contrast that with the way Jesus calls us to. So I want to dive in. Let's begin with the fundamental thing that all marketers are trying to do, and that's position themselves, their brand, their product in your mind. Terry O'Reilly says this: the art of positioning a product in your mind is probably the most important act in marketing. For advertisers, positioning is all about trying to get inside your head and make their brand, their product stand out to you. So think of it this way: off the top of your head, how many brands of tires can you name? Goodyear, Michelin, Firestone. For a lot of us, probably, right, one or two brands come to mind, which is a big problem because there are about 20 of them. And it highlights the problem that all marketers face when we're so inundated with products and brands. How do you get yours to stand out? How do you rise above the competition? Consider George St. Pierre. How many of you are familiar with George St. Pierre? Look at all you violent people. Love your violent sports, do you? Yeah. Kristen, she can't stand violence of any kind, and yet she has an affection for him. I can't understand why. It's interesting to me. Now, George St. Pierre, when he became the UFC welterweight champion, he's a mixed martial artist, a violent fighter, you could say. When he became the welterweight champion, he wanted to leverage how popular he had become and use that to profit for himself. He wanted to gain sponsorships and advertisements. But George had a big problem. See, most companies see the UFC as a blood sport. It's way too violent. Nobody wants to attach their brand or their product to somebody who gets in a cage and punches people and does bad things to them. Very few people wanted George to be the spokesman for their product. He was just another fighter. But George St. Pierre did something interesting. He hired the ad agency Sid Lee to help him cultivate his brand, and they came up with a fascinating strategy. What Sid Lee did was position GSP not as a fighter. No, he's not a fighter. What he is an elite athlete. And they began to market him across all these channels as not a fighter, an elite athlete. He's in the same ranks as Peyton Manning or Derek Jeter, or Tiger Woods, Sidney Crosby. And it worked like a charm. St. Pierre's endorsement deals, they doubled in 14 months. Not only that, he was getting paid large sums of money from them. Gatorade signed on, Under Armour signed on. And all because what they did is they took GSP and took him outside of being a fighter and placed him at the top of the ladder of prestigious athletes. They placed him in the upper echelon of athletes, and it paid off for him big time. They positioned him in a very different way. Or consider this band. Some of you probably haven't heard of them. They were big back in the 1960s, but they did something very interesting. They arrived in the scene late in 1964. They named themselves the Beau Brummels. And their choice of name was not random. You see, they kind of looked like the Beatles. They kind of sounded like the Beatles. In fact, they even had a hit record. But the name, the Beau Brummels, was strategic because it happened to put them directly next to the Beatles in record store bins. If you think about it, Beatles, B-E-A-T, sits right next to B-E-A-U. And their strategy was fascinating because what they counted on, and it worked, is that when people rushed to get the latest Beatles album and found it sold out, the very next thing they would touch would be the Beau Brummels. Fascinating. It was the case of perfect positioning. Again, as Terry O'Reilly says, the art of positioning a product in your mind is probably the most important act in marketing. And I would say this, because we swim in a sea of advertising, I would suggest what we have learned and absorbed is the same message about ourselves. We have learned that the art of positioning ourselves is the most important act in determining how other people see us, how we obtain status, respect, privilege. We've come to learn that how we position ourselves eventually defines us. And so our identities, over time, they become more about how we position ourselves than they do with the content of our character. Our identities, in fact, become synonymous with the positions we take in life. So what is your position in politics? On this specific issue, on that, how do you position yourself? What is your position? We've taken from the marketing game this, our position and our identity eventually become synonymous. And what is more, the way we position ourselves in life becomes our path, our route to social power, social esteem, prestige within our social circles. But in the world of branding and advertising, it's not simply how you position yourself. It's actually about your ability to reposition your competition. So what a lot of brands spend a lot of time doing is trying to disable the competition. I think Avis has a perfect example of this. In the 1960s, Hertz was the number one car rental company. So Avis wanted to steal market share from Hertz, so they had a very interesting strategy. They decided to reposition Hertz like this. Consider this advertise. Avis is only number two in rent-a-car, so why go with us? Because we try harder. Which was a brilliant message, because what they were saying, the real message was, Hertz is number one, so they've stopped trying. Go with number two, because we try harder. Or this next one, another Avis ad said this, we can't afford to make you wait. And the real message is this, because they're number one, they can afford to do whatever they want, not us. We'll work harder. We can't afford to make you wait. It's classic repositioning. And so what ended up happening is they gained 35% of the market share by positioning themselves as number two while cutting down number one competition. Or Tylenol, perhaps one of the biggest ones is what Tylenol did to aspirin. Aspirin was like the leading painkiller for 70 years, but they had a small problem. For a small group of people, it caused bleeding in their stomach. So what did Tylenol do? They advertised to that effect. For the millions, a little hyperbole there, who should not take aspirin. Why? It'll make your stomach bleed. And it was brilliant on two levels, because if you had stomach issues, you would naturally stay away from aspirin. Everyone else going, well, I don't want to take that risk. And what happened? Nobody gets aspirin anymore. We all get Tylenol, right? They became the number one brand of painkiller. We see this all the time in marketing and advertising. The most famous one is probably, of course, the Mac and PC commercials. Mac altered the perception, right? If you own a PC, that's the computer of nerds. As Terry O'Reilly notes, there's one irrefutable fact in marketing. If you want to grow your business, that business has to come from somewhere, namely your competitors. And I would say this, it works much the same way in our social worlds, because we tend to believe that power, prestige, respect is sort of a finite resource. It has to come from somewhere, and if we're going to get it, a lot of times what it means is taking it from other people. In the world of marketing, they call this repositioning. In social worlds, we call this gossip. Gossip. Gossip is really just a way of repositioning other people in their minds. And it is fascinating to me how often I do this. It's become for many of us almost an unconscious response. What I want to do is this. I want to teach you this morning how to gossip. You probably don't need to know how. It comes instinctually to us. But sometimes when you break down the anatomy of something, it becomes fascinating. So how do you gossip? How do you reposition someone, lower someone else in the minds of others? Three simple steps. First is this. Point out an unspoken standard. I'll use myself as an example because it'd be weird to actually gossip about one of you here. But I told you a couple weeks ago that my friend Riley thinks I'm emotionally distant. So if you wanted to gossip about me, it's very, very easy to do. Very, very easy. Here's what you do. You start with a question. Brad's a really nice guy, but have you noticed he's a little emotionally distant? Boom. You have set the ball in motion. Because what you've done is just reposition by setting up a standard. What you've done is what Tylenol did to aspirin. You've set a standard that says being emotionally distant is unacceptable. Being emotionally available is the standard we should operate by. And then the next step to gossiping is to simply let your dialogue partner fill in the blanks. So, Brad, you notice he's kind of emotionally distant. Just back off at that point, because what our brains tend to do is then they go searching for evidence. So your partner will stand there going, huh, you know what, come to think of it, you know, he's never told me about his feelings recently. That does sort of make sense. He is a bit emotionally distant. And so we become the partner. We begin to affirm in our mind, yes, that example, he's never given me a hug. He's whatever it is. Yes, he is emotionally distant. And then you simply end, you've already cut me down. You simply end by restating the standard and voila, you've got some magic on your hand. So find Brad emotionally distant? Actually, yes, I do. I don't know. I just feel it's important to be emotionally available. In 30 seconds, you can literally cut someone down, take them down a few notches by setting up a standard, telling somebody else how that person doesn't live up to the standard, and then repeating and affirming the standard. It's a fascinating process that most of us do day in and day out, and we have no clue what's going on. So happy gossiping today. Next thing, you're going to be all freaked out. Every time you talk about someone, you're like, oh my goodness, am I doing it? But it's a fascinating thing, and we're consistently warned, particularly in Scripture, about the dangers of gossiping, because what it really is a marketing play. It's simply a way to say, listen, I want to take this person down so that I can elevate myself. And in conversations, we find ourselves doing it all the time. There's one other interesting tactic that marketers employ when they want to gain status, and that's something called ambush marketing, which is simply this. They find an existing ad by someone else and intrude on its message so that they get the recognition or the glory. And it's kind of funny, I have to confess. What happened was this. In the spring of 2010, Apple put up a billboard advertising their nano iPods. And this one appeared in Montreal, and so Rona came along and decided to ambush it because they had a paint recycling program at Rona where you could return your paint to Rona, and so what they did is they came along and they did this. They put up a sign underneath it showing the exact colors dripping off the iPod advertisement into their paint cans. This got shown all over the world, so they took Apple's ad and simply stole the thunder. Fascinating. Or consider what happened recently when Audi placed a billboard advertising its new A4 sedan. The headline was this, Your move, BMW. And so BMW very quickly erected their own billboard with their own car, which said this, checkmate. It's kind of brilliant, right? They saw a story being played out and said, we can jump in and steal the glory, the thunder here. But my all-time favorite was an ambush move by Virgin Airlines. Back in 1999, who's been on the London Eye? Anyone been when you're in London? It's marvelous, right? It's a great thing. The London Eye was set to launch in 1999. It was a momentous occasion and was sponsored by British Airways. And so on the launch day in 1999, British Airways, they had assembled the whole, like a vast media conglomerate had descended on London to cover this big moment. But they ran into a technical problem that morning. It prevented the giant wheel from being erected. And so there was this 7-hour delay while the media waited, while they were trying to get the London Eye up and off the ground. Now, when Richard Branson heard about this, he thought, oh, here's an opportunity. So within a couple of hours, he put a blimp in the sky and had this sign put on it. BA can't get it up. Come on, that's funny. And so the marketing, the media world is waiting for an event to happen, and they can't get this wheel up. And Virgin comes along and says, let's play on this a little bit. It totally stole the show. Instead of everyone thinking about British Airways, they were enamored with this sign floating above London. Brilliant. What advertisers like to do is intrude on and steal the thunder from other companies, which I'm sure many of us can relate to. If you've ever been in a group of people and told a story about someone or something and had somebody jump in immediately after you with a better story, you know all about ambush marketing, right? Have you ever done that to someone? I gotta watch myself how often I do that. I was just with my brothers on Friday night, and my brother was telling a story about Arizona, which I've been there, and I caught myself while he's telling the story just standing there go, are you done so I can tell my better story? Are you? I just want to, can you finish because I got a better story? And we do that sort of thing all the time, right? And what is that really doing? It's a way of ambushing somebody's moment, somebody's story, and elevating ourselves by stealing it from them. You know, in thousands of little ways, we've become trained at the fine art of elevating our own personal brands over others. You say this, I think we're sort of swimming in a world of marketing and branding, so we intuitively understand how we can position ourselves in order to gain more power, more privilege, more respect, status, esteem from others. We instinctively know how to reposition other people, how to intrude on other people's stories. We instinctively know, right? Marketing has taught us to buy, buy, buy. But what it's also done is taught us how to manipulate ourselves and see ourselves as a brand, as a product, essentially, that we're trying to elevate. Marketers are obsessed with positioning their products above others, and I think one of the perpetual struggles we have as human beings is that we're constantly trying to elevate ourselves above others as well. It's all about positioning. And it turns out, right, Jesus was incredibly concerned about positioning as well. In fact, in the world of marketing and branding, the name of the game is this. How can you stand out? How can you become more noticeable? How can you differentiate yourself from everyone else? How can you knock your competitors down a peg or two? But in Jesus' kingdom, in his world order, it works in the exact opposite way. Consider this passage, one of my favorites from Philippians. Paul here, he's trying to articulate Jesus' position in the Godhead. An explanation of the Trinity, we'll talk about that later in the spring. But consider this passage. I find it to be absolutely remarkable. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Now remember, this is the fuel behind every marketing campaign, This is the fuel behind personal branding. It's the fuel behind gossip, the fuel behind how we choose to frame ourselves. But he goes on, each of you should look not only to your own interests, but also to the interests of others. Your attitude should be the same as that of Christ Jesus, who, being in the very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. What we learn through this passage is that even though Jesus has elite status, he empties himself, makes himself nothing. In the Christian tradition, this is what we call kenosis, which means emptying out. When it says Jesus humbled himself, the word is kenosis. It's an emptying. It's a distinctly Christian practice of intentionally moving on a downward path from power and privilege to servanthood. And what this practice is designed to do is to empty us of all the things that our ego rests its identity on. In Christianity, the idea of servanthood captures sort of the manifestation of kenosis. Kenosis means serving, to take the role of a servant. You see this again in John chapter 13. This is at the Last Supper. Jesus is about to make a demonstration. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So he got up from the meal and took off his outer clothing, wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. Jesus, in a position of power, given a position of power, eschews it to play the role of servant. It's marketing and branding in the exact opposite direction. You say this, Jesus comes to replace moving above and beyond with moving below and beside. I think the closest parallel, because we don't get servanthood idea. I think the closest parallel would be going to a restroom and finding a celebrity being the bathroom attendant. Have you ever had that experience, a bathroom attendant? Do you know what I'm talking about? I've only had this once in my life. Chris and I, we were at a resort and it was kind of swanky or whatever, and we were sitting down to dinner, and I went to use the washroom, and there was a bathroom attendant in there. If you've never had this experience, it's fascinating. It's a little disconcerting at first because there's just a guy just standing there while you do your business. But when you're done and you go up to the sink, he turns on the water for you. And then you wash your hands. He puts the soap in. He gets you something to dry your hands. And so he did that. And then afterwards, he's like, would you like some mouthwash? Oh, yes, I would. So I took some mouthwash, gargled, spit it out. He's like, how about one of our many colognes? Well, this is good. So put on some cologne. I don't even own cologne, so this was a big deal to me, and I was feeling pretty high status. Came back to the table. Kristen's like, oh, you smell good. I'm like, oh, yeah, you should see what they got in the bathroom there, bathroom attendant. She's like, did you tip him? I said, no. I said, no, is that supposed to happen? She's like, you have to tip a bathroom attendant. I felt so horrible. I hadn't tipped the guy, so now I had to plan to make another bathroom visit so I could tip the guy. So I went back like 15 minutes later. He said, yeah, back again. I said, small bladder. So I pretended to use the bathroom and then went back again and kind of did the dumb and dumber thing, kind of pulled out my money, gave him a tip. The world was right. But Chris and I were chatting about this after. Is there any more demeaning job than standing all day in a bathroom while people do their business and then helping you wash your hands, helping you freshen up your breath? I mean, it's sort of a very, what we would consider a very low status job. And the fascinating thing is that this is exactly the sort of thing we see Jesus doing here. I've got power, I've got status, and I'm going to take on the mantle of bathroom attendant. And this is what Jesus says, this is the path to follow. The kenosis path of emptying ourselves from what our egos rest on. It might be one of the most difficult things in the world to do. Because we have these sort of neurotic anxieties, don't we? I don't want to move downward. I think the truth is we all thirst for attention, right? We want the applause. We want the accolades. It's hard to step out of the limelight and sort of willingly go and be unnoticed, unrecognized. I think all of this pushes us towards a question Henry Nouwen once asked that I love. Is this: who am I when nobody pays attention or says thanks or recognizes my work? In the world of marketing and positioning, if you're not noticed, you're a nobody. And that answer stings, right? None of us want to take on the form of a servant. We don't want to be a nobody. I want to be a somebody. And so we resist this downward sort of self-emptying path of kenosis because it runs counter to the air that we're all breathing of marketing and branding and trying to set ourselves up apart from others. So what I want to do this morning is this. I want to finish up with talking specifically about what I think this kenosis path looks like for us. And the reality is this idea of going lower can be a bit abusive to people who are already really low. So I want to talk about what does the kenosis path look like when you're already low, and what does it look like for others of us who have privilege, esteem, respect. But let me start essentially kenosis for those without privilege. What does kenosis look like if you're already a person of low status? What does emptying yourself look like if you're already empty? How much lower do you have to go? See, the problem throughout Christian history is this idea has been used to keep low people low. We all know what it shouldn't look like. We don't use kenosis, or we never should use this idea to justify telling already low people, marginalized people, to stay there. But Sarah Coakley, fascinating author, she did a work called Kenosis and Subversion, and she says this: for those without privilege or status, kenosis path is this. It's emptying yourself not to go lower, but in order to rise. Which I find fascinating. Specifically, what the low person is asked to empty themselves of is our cultural understanding of positioning. Because all of us carry a sonar in our minds. We understand how culture is set up and positions us. And so we're called to rid ourselves of the toxic ways we've internalized how culture understands our position in life. Because a cultural positioning system is sort of downloaded into us. It tells us this is what gives you significance, this is what doesn't. This which means success, this means failure. This means you're worthy, this means you're unworthy. The emptying of kenosis is the practice of becoming indifferent to it all. Emptying it out, spewing out, dying to the cultural positioning system. And so for those of us here this morning who might feel that you deserve to be at the bottom because you feel maybe you're insignificant, or maybe you feel like you're damaged or unworthy, the call is to empty ourselves of the ways we've internalized and come to believe cultural positioning systems. I think a lot of this is done in prayer, allowing ourselves to be emptied of that anger. Because if you're angry about your situation in life, it still means you kind of believe the way culture positions you. And it's the call to empty that, stop believing the lie, rid ourselves of the bitterness, the cynicism, the anger. Because to hold on to those things is simply a way, it affirms our cultural positioning system. And so we work to empty ourselves of that. But what about kenosis for those of us who are privileged? We have a bit more power, status, respect. I want to give you a series of questions that might help on just a practical level, help us understand what it means to lower ourselves even just slightly. The first would be this. How interruptible are you? I've talked about this at Nexus once before. Interruptions are a nuisance. They threaten our agenda, our way, our plans. Because the reality, I think, is this. To be the kind of person who embraces interruptions in their day is the very definition of taking a low status position in life, right? The people who do interrupting are essentially, even just momentarily, if someone interrupts you, what they are saying is, my status, my agenda right now matters more than yours. And that's a hard lesson to learn. To be interruptible is to take a low status position in life. And we see this all the time in Jesus' life and ministry, right? He's walking along, people calling from the margins, and you see the disciples all the time, essentially, shut up, go away. And Jesus is like, no, I can be interrupted. And so Jesus makes room for others who, for even just a moment, put their agenda ahead of his. Or how cheerful are we? How uncomplaining are we? Generally, what I found is this. Complaints run downhill, right? High status to low status. People who are high in status, they're the ones who do the complaining. I've got an issue, and because I have status, I want someone to fix it. That's what a high status person often does. I'll do the complaining. But to be cheerful and uncomplaining, whether it's at work, with friends, that signals, okay, I'm low status. I have servant status. Or what about this? Are we willing to admit error and mistakes? On the opposite of the end of the spectrum, apologies typically flow uphill from low status to high, right? One of the things I've noticed about Zoe in particular, she just turned 5, is she apologizes a lot. And I started counting how often she apologizes compared to how often I apologize, and it's a vast difference. Every time she even sees me scowl, sorry, sorry. Why? Because I think she instinctually understands she is lower status, and lower status people are quick to apologize. They're quick to admit mistakes. How quick are we to admit our mistakes, admit errors, and apologize? Pride for us high status people gets in the way, right? Or what about this? Do we dress in a way that signals high status? I had a fascinating conversation when I was in Uganda. I had a friend in Uganda, and we were driving along on the bus one day, and she was explaining to me the kind of men that she was attracted to. And we went by this group of people, this group of men in a field, and they were cutting the grass like this, and they all had their shirts off, and they were ripped. And I said, so, you know, what kind of guy do you find attractive? And she said, no, not the ripped people in the fields. They do not, I'm not attracted to them at all. I said, what? No, she said, here in Uganda, if you're ripped and skinny, it's a sign that you do manual labor. And that's a sign of low status. So the kind of men I'm interested in are larger men. I'm like, why? It's like, because that means they don't have to work. They can sit around. I thought, well, that's absolutely fascinating to me. And it got me thinking and helped me realize how oftentimes appearance can be a signal of status. And let's be honest, right? I don't want to make too many of us uncomfortable. Some of us have to wear certain things at work. That's just what's expected of us. That's not what I'm talking about. Outside of that, we can be tempted, I think, into dressing certain ways that signal we're high status. And I think one of the things is this, to be comfortable in modest, comfortable clothing, less expensive clothing, it signals I'm okay being lower status. I'm okay if I'm not seen as someone who's high. Or what about this? Do we speak in ways that signal we are high status? I have 3 brothers. My oldest brother is a Mennonite pastor. My second oldest brother is a professor at UVic in political science. Then there's me, pastor. And then my youngest brother sells salt. And when the 4 of us get together, we have a great time. But as you can imagine, with an atheist professor and 2 pastors, we oftentimes have spirited conversations. And my younger brother, who sells salt, is agnostic, doesn't really care. He tends to sit there silently. And this year, the 4 of us, we were at a cottage for a weekend together, and we're talking about everything, theology, all this stuff. My brother Mike was just sitting there silently, and finally he spoke up. He's like, have you guys heard yourselves? I'm like, what do you mean? It's like, all you guys do is name drop constantly. Have you read this author? Oh, have you considered this new idea? He's like, all you guys do is talk big words that normal people don't understand. You name drop all the time. The big authors you've read, oh, if you haven't read so-and-so, you don't know what you're talking about. It's like, that's all you guys do. And he was right. There's a sort of vying when you're around other people that oftentimes we can use our language as a way to signal we're high status. We're not among the uneducated. And we saw this, right? You know where? South of the border. Part of the appeal was he just talks like he's grade 3 vocabulary. And it's an important lesson for us, though, because oftentimes our language can signal that we're elite, that we know more. And I think a lot of people get tired of it. Like, stop pretending you're higher than you are. I think we can use language as a weapon and make people feel small because we use our big words, our big ideas, philosophical ideas. Nobody has a clue what we're talking about, but they sit there going, oh, that person's intelligent. It was a huge lesson for me listening to my brother. He's like, you just seem so arrogant when you name drop authors and use big words. I was thinking if he was here this morning, he would have been like, are you kidding me with the kenosis word? Like, you couldn't have found something else for... I apologize. I had to sneak that one in. But it's like, stop it. How often do we use our words, our ideas, to indicate that we're higher status? You know, these are small questions to ask ourselves. They're small ways to measure how we position ourselves. But the reality is we've been trained in so many different ways to make ourselves stand above others. But to pursue the emptying path of kenosis as Christ did, it means rejecting the positioning system of our culture. And there are myriads of ways to do that, right? But it means practicing becoming indifferent to how our self-concepts have been shaped and defined by our culture, whether that's for good or ill. But swimming in a sea of marketing and branding, we've been taught, this is how you position yourself. This is how you craft your identity so that you're close to power, so you're close to prestige. We've inhaled the air. And so Jesus calls us to something radically different, away from the path of status and elevation and towards kenosis, where we empty ourselves, to empty ourselves. It means this. It means finding ourselves in the end, remembering our value is not found in our position in life, but in the divine image within us. And anything that tells you otherwise is a lie. And so, my charge, you could say, this week, this month, this year, is may you come to know in ever deeper ways that the way up really is down. So, I'm going to ask the band to come and just, they're going to do the closing opening number, but maybe we'll do some questions and then Murray's going to close us in prayer, but we'll get the band set up.